Welcome to Signs of Life, exploring survival of consciousness. Brought to you by Forever Family Foundation. On the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
I call your name. The echo is haunting. The echo is always the same. I call your name. The echo is haunting. An echo can never be changed. So I call your name.
Hello and welcome to Signs of Life, brought to you by Forever Family Foundation with our host, Bob Ginsberg. I'm Fran Ginsberg, and our show tonight is sponsored by the Comlock Center, and they can be found on the web at comlock.com. That's K-A-M-L-A-K.com. Our guest tonight is Dr. James G. Matlock, and if you have a question, comment, or would like to talk to our guest, the toll-free number here is 888-627-6008. Bob?
And Dr. James Matlock is a research fellow with the Parapsychology Foundation and has worked at the American Society for Psychical Research and at the Rhine Research Center. He has published widely on reincarnation and related issues and is co-author with Erlander Haraldson of I Saw a Light and Came Here, Children's Experiences of Reincarnation. He teaches courses on reincarnation, and his new book is entitled Signs of Reincarnation, Exploring Beliefs, Cases, and Theory. And Dr. Matlock's website to learn more is jamesgmatlock.com. Welcome back to the show, Jim. It's a pleasure to have you.
Well, thank you, Bob. I'm glad to be here.
No, you, as I mentioned in the title, I mean, you have various cases in your book, and you begin the book with a past life memory case of a girl named Ryle Ann. And what struck me is, you know, as a young child, she talked about the time in between lives, where she even mentioned that she played with other children until it was time for her to be born. So do many reincarnation cases include conversations about life between lives?
Yes, actually, quite a few do. About 20% of the cases that have been studied have these what we call intermission memories, that is, memories of the period between death and rebirth.
Mm. So, I mean, so she also said that, well, by saying that not everyone comes back, and you can choose to come back even if you died before you were supposed to, that would infer to me that we have a predetermined exit point that, of course, could be altered by free will. So what are your thoughts about that?
Well, yes, she said that. But I think we have to take that with a sort of grain of salt, right? I mean, Yeah. You know, she said, among other things, people usually only come back twice. Well, we know that's not the case because there are some children and also adults who remember several lives. So it's certainly not the case that now she may only remember the one previous life, but that doesn't mean that's the that's the only one she lived. Just because people say these things, we can't necessarily take them as gospel truth. I think.
Right. Absolutely. Well, you know what, and for our listeners, I mean, I know that you and your fellow researchers, when you talk about reincarnation research, you talk about cases that are ultimately solved or unsolved. So can you get into that a little bit? What's the difference?
Sure. By unsolved, we mean a case in which that has been investigated, we haven't been able to find the person whose life was remembered. A solved case is simply one in which the person whose life is remembered has been identified. It's as simple as that.
Yeah, and that's done generally through meticulous investigation, getting records, visiting the families of the lives that were remembered and that sort of thing?
Yes, With children, one of the valuable things about working with children is that typically the lives that they recall would not live very far in the past. In Asia, the intermissions tend to be particularly brief, only a few months or a few years. And the children remember enough details that you can actually go back and, find their previous family, friends that they remember, and this sort of thing. And so it's relatively easy then to actually trace the previous families and confirm the things that they said. For some reason in the West, in Ryland's case, is a Western American case, the intermission is much longer. In her case, it's 25 years, which is a good deal longer than we find in most Asian cases. And yet, it's not so long that I couldn't find people who remembered her and remembered her dying in the way that she said and was able to confirm that. So, and I was also able to get hold of her autopsy report, which can help confirm things too. But even without that document, I was able to confirm things simply by talking to people that she knew.
Yeah. In general, when you another researcher, investigates a case and then accompanies the child to the previous family, is there a typical reaction from the previous family when they see evidence that this might be the reincarnation of their loved one? I mean, do they react usually positively or sometimes even negatively when the identification is made?
Well, there are a couple of steps there. You say when the identification is made, they have to be confident that it was correct. And so initially the response is one of maybe a little bit of skepticism. And they'll test the child in various ways. You think of the stories you hear of the Dalai Lama, and the tests that are conducted there to find the right child who is the reincarnation of the previous Dalai Lama. Well, it's very similar to the sorts of tests that the families will do, the previous family will do. Not necessarily giving them, objects to try to recognize, but they'll ask test questions. And they'll listen to the memories, they'll listen to the child talk. The child will often recognize people and recognize the house, often show the way to the house, show the way around the house, and so forth. And all of these things combined then serve to convince the previous family that indeed this child is the reincarnation of their loved one. And at that point, when they've accepted it, they're usually quite accepting of the child and quite pleased to have him there. In fact, many families in Asia will try to adopt the child, or some will. One of the things we often don't think about is that this then can be a motive for the child's family not to even allow it to go back to the previous village and meet the previous family because they're afraid that they're going to lose the child to an adoption.
Mm.
It doesn't happen very often. There are cases where they actually were adopted, but that's one response which you can get.
Yeah. It's funny, when I first started doing some extensive reading about reincarnation, I was really skeptical because my only introduction to the topic was I would read reports that people would always claim to be famous people. Was Cleopatra, I was
right.
Tut, and it seemed so absurd to me, but the after reading Stevenson's work and yours and Tucker's and so forth, I mean, it's clear that in the overwhelming majority of cases, it's just people are just ordinary people, right?
In the child cases, definitely. In the adult cases, you get more of these what we call FPL, famous past lives, and I think that's because of simply pattern matching. In a lot of the adult cases, the memories are set further back in time, sometimes much further back in time. but the memories are still fragmentary. They could be, you know, and so in an attempt to try to figure out who they were, you know, naturally there's much more information available on famous people, you know, and so in trying to match up the memories to a person whose life is known, they naturally, you know, hit on the famous people first. And I think that's why in adult cases you so often see these FBLs.
Yeah.
But with children, you don't. You're quite right.
We're going to go to a quick break, but we're talking with Dr. James Matlock. His new book is called Signs of Reincarnation, Exploring Beliefs, Cases, and Theory. Website is jamesgmatlock.com. We have a lot of interesting things to talk about, so stay with us. We'll be back in a few minutes.
The Camlack Center is putting birth and death back together again. Aimed at changing the way we look at death, the Camlack Center was founded in 2002 as a publishing company and teaching center. When we know that there is nothing but life, we realize that birth and death are events in time and space. Our grief can open us to other dimensions of reality and allow us to experience our loved ones who are no longer in the physical body. Our events and products are based on personal experiences of survival of consciousness after physical death and decades of research into how death has influenced the development of our consciousness. Visit www.camlack.com, that's K-A-M-L-A-K.com, for articles, videos, books, and more to help you cope with the loss of a loved one.
We all grieve in different ways, and let's face it, grief hurts. Losing a loved one is usually the hardest event we will ever face. We can throw our hands up and become hardened by our grief, or we can take positive steps to transform it. Love Knows No Death, a groundbreaking and powerful grief transformation method, can be what you've been looking for to provide some peace and understanding. It was created and written by medical doctor and professor Dr. Piero Calvi Perazzetti, and it's a combination of a self-help workbook and video course. The workbook has the power to lessen grief and foster significant healing, and has already helped countless people to not only lead productive lives, but to do so with the knowledge that they will indeed see their loved ones again. The workbook could be purchased for $19.95 on Amazon or on the foreverfamilyfoundation.org grief and loss page, where a digital version is also available for $9.95. Love knows no death. Truer words have never been spoken.
Imagine seeing spirits are spontaneously speaking indigenous Brazilian rainforest languages. Janet Mayer, a psychic medium, does just that. In her new book, Spirits, They Are Present, she opens the door to her private life in order to share her compelling, fearful, and at times humorous journey, providing evidence that when we die, we simply make a transition to another life. Spirits, They Are Present, available now at www.janetmayer.net, Amazon, and other online booksellers. Order your copy today.
I would like to introduce you to the Forever Family Foundation, a nonprofit organization whose mission is to provide a forum where individuals and families who have suffered the loss of a loved one can turn for support, information, and hope. We believe in the continuity of the family, even though a member has left the physical world. The Forever Family Foundation is a joint effort of scientists, research mediums, and interested people who support the premise that life does not end with physical death. We wish to prove that the bond of the family cannot be broken even by death. We invite anyone who's trying to cope with the loss of a loved one to contact the Forever Family Foundation at 631-425-7707. That's 631-425-7707. Or you can find us on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
Welcome back to Signs of Life, brought to you by Forever Family Foundation.
For those just tuning in, our guest this evening is Dr. James G. Matlock, Our sponsor tonight is the Comlock Center, and they can be found on the web at comlock.com. Bob?
And we're back with Dr. Matlock. You know, before I forget, reincarnation is such an interesting topic, and so many people want to learn more about it. I know that you moderate or started a Facebook group where people can write in and discuss the topic. How do people join that?
Well, if they're on Facebook, the group is called Signs of Reincarnation, and you can just it's a closed group on Facebook, but you just they just apply to join. So they should just search for the group called Signs of Reincarnation and apply.
Okay.
That's all.
All right. Good information. You know, a lot of skeptics of reincarnation often try to explain the memories as, you know, manifestations of various psi abilities, you know, perhaps pulling the information from a field of data. Do children who exhibit these past life memories often exhibit enhanced psi ability?
No, very few do. Ryland had a little bit of that, but very, very few do. And one of the things interesting about that, for those that do have the psi ability, they often have connections to the previous family. That is, that they'll become aware of things that the previous family is going through, or if somebody dies, you know, somebody that they knew in the previous life dies, their previous father, something like that, you know, they'll feel that very strongly, emotionally as well. But one of the things, you know, I'm glad you brought that up, actually, because these cases involve much more than simply the memories of information. They include behaviors, too. I just mentioned emotions. You know, and we can get more into that if you want, and also physical features. So, you know, on the whole, I mean, yes, skeptics like to say that, but at least the parapsychologically oriented ones. The more materialist ones, they don't believe in psi anyway. But parapsychologists often do try to attribute these cases to psi, and it just doesn't work.
Yeah, and as you've mentioned, it's a little difficult to comprehend how, if they are extracting information from a field of data, it seems to be a little bit more difficult to extract a personality or a behavior, you know, than it would be from a factual date, right? So that makes sense to me. You know, one question I wanted to ask you, because we get asked this a lot at the foundation, especially with people who go to mediums or try to communicate with discarnate entities, and they're fearful in many cases of their deceased loved one reincarnating, because in their mind that would mean the end of the communication. So, I mean, do you think that it's possible that one's soul or one's consciousness, you know, can split after physical death, so that one part might be in an afterlife realm while another part reincarnates?
Well, you know, it's interesting that in some tribal societies they do believe that as part of this sort of the animistic worldview, that one can survive in the afterlife so there can be ancestral spirits that one can continue to interact with at the same time as there can be reincarnation. There's not a great deal of evidence for that. I can't rule it out. But there's more of, it's more of a belief than something that has any solid backing for it. But let me say something else about this issue, and that is this. I remember what I commented earlier, that the intermissions tend to be much longer in Western societies than they are in Asia.
Right.
And one possibility is that the reason for that is that it allows, if intermission is decades long, it allows for communications through mediums or to be seen as apparitions, other sorts of interactions before reincarnation. And, you know, the best mediumistic communicators stop communicating after a couple of decades, three or four decades. You know, they just stop, and this is something that's been very well known for a long time. And so, as it turns out, that that point fits very well with the reincarnation case data, the Western data.
Right. You know, so I think it's a fair statement that the vast majority of among the metaphysical community, they believe that we keep reincarnating to learn specific lessons and to balance out karma based upon our past deeds or to elevate one's soul. And I know that you don't think that this is necessarily the case, right?
I don't, mainly because I just don't see that represented in the case data. There's really just not much evidence of spiritual growth from one life to the next, or development. What we do see is continuities, is consistencies of personality, of interest, of psychological problems even. Those can carry over from one life to the next. But we don't see a trajectory of spiritual growth as such.
So that would lead to the question of, you know, what if there is a purpose, what would be the purpose of reincarnation? I mean, you know, who makes the choice and why, you know, for what reason?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Well, one possibility is that the basic purpose of it is simply to give us a head start on the next life. That is, to help with our social and cultural adjustments. It turns out that in the great majority of cases, the reincarnation is in the same geographical area, typically even in the same ethnic group or same racial group. They're exceptions, but they're just that. They're exceptions. They're not typical. And so I tend to think that one of the purposes is simply to help us. I'll give you a sort of a counterexample to that. In we'll call international cases, that is, where you reincarnate, you know, in another country, or even in another linguistic group in the same country. The children will often have difficulty learning their native language, but they will use words from the language of the previous life. So it's as if, the memories of the previous life are keeping them, holding them back a little bit. So that's how I feel about that, that it's more likely just to be about helping us adapt, rather than putting us on this spiritual growth curve.
Mm. You mentioned animism before, and I know in animism it's believed that the soul is embodied, but the spirit is not. What are they referring to? Can you elaborate on that?
Well, that's sort of generalization or my gloss on these beliefs, trying to convey the idea there, which is that really there's no distinction made necessarily between an embodied soul or embodied spirit and a disembodied one. I mean, they're continuous, and that's
right.
The point consciousness or the mind or the spirit or soul, whatever we want to call it, I think they're pretty much the same thing. You know, there are differences in the way we and the meanings that we attach to those, but basically it's the same concept, I think. And, you know, so one can, when translating the terms into English, because remember, they all use their own languages, right? And no languages
right.
are exactly, can be matched up exactly. But in trying to convey the ideas that they have in animistic societies, it seems to me that when they use the term that can be translated as soul, they're thinking of an embodied stream of consciousness or an embodied, essence. And when they think of that essence, that same essence continuous with the embodied life, continuing on after death, it's better translated by the word spirit. So that's what I'm trying to convey there, that basically soul and spirit are synonymous, but in animistic cultures, you know, there'll be, you know, the stress on the embodied part and the stress on the disembodied part, but they're continuous.
Mm. So I've noticed that in a great many of the reincarnation cases that involve the previous life being ended abruptly by accident or violence, any speculation on why this is the case?
I think, keep in mind that when we talk about these cases, we're talking about cases that have been solved, right? And in order to be solved, there have to be memories. There are these other things, too, their behaviors and physical features very often. But they start with the memories. I mean, it's the memories, the things that the kids say or the adults say, that allow us to identify the previous life, right, the previous person. And so it may not be that we reincarnate more often when deaths are violent, but just that we remember them more often or more easily. And so violent deaths, accidental deaths, sudden deaths are more frequently represented in the cases than peaceful deaths, you know, in old age are. There are a few of those. It's not like there are none of them. But you're quite right. I mean, in close to a majority of solved cases, and actually over 60% of unsolved cases, there is a violent death. Mm. And I think it's simply because there's a more memorable, a violent death is also an unfinished life, and that may be another something that causes the memories to surface in the awareness and of the new life, the new person.
Yeah, you know, I was very interested and surprised in the book when I read about the memories of your own daughter. Was she reached the conclusion
on her own
that she was remembering a past life? So can you tell us a little bit about how she expressed that for the first time?
Yeah, well, she was three, and, you know, these memories are not all that uncommon. I mean, I've talked with a lot of people now, and in my Facebook group, you know, a lot of people will come in. I think these things are actually much more, that is, children who have these memories say these things, are much more common than we realize, simply because we don't share them with each other. Now, that's changing a little bit. People are more open now. Social media helped a lot in that. But anyway, Christina, she was three, and the first thing she said, we were driving, and we had come to a traffic light, which was red, and I stopped, and there was a motorcycle ahead of us at the light, and she said to me, "Daddy, do you like to ride on motos?" Her mother is Peruvian, and we were raising her to be bilingual, right? Moto is short for motocicleta, the Spanish word for motorcycle, so that's the word she used. Although, you know, but she asked me in English, "Daddy, do you like to ride on motos?" And I don't. They make me very uncomfortable. They scare me. And I said, "No, honey, I don't. They scare me." And she said very earnestly, "You have to hold on real tight, you know." And I said, "Well, honey, when did you ride on a motorcycle?" Because it sounded like she was speaking from experience. Because I was thinking, you know, her mother would take her back to Lima. She didn't like American winters, so she would take her back over the winter every year. And so we hadn't been together continuously. I was working at that period, during that period. So she said, "No, it was a long time ago, before I came to you and Mommy." So that's the first thing she said about this. And so she had figured out by that point that the images that she had in her mind, and she must have had them for some time, she couldn't tell me just how long she had them, it felt to her like, you know, maybe she'd always had them. But she figured out on her own that this was a previous life.
Wow. That was, and you were already very much open and researching the stuff. So to you, it was, I guess, not a tremendous surprise, right?
Well, it was rather stunning. I wasn't expecting my daughter to come out with this. I had been studying reincarnation for some time, that's right. I first started studying it around 1980. But at this point, I wasn't really involved in reincarnation research. I got involved in it again later. But during this period, I wasn't really. And so she hadn't heard me talk about it. She hadn't heard her mother talk about it. It's not something that came up on TV a lot, you know, then. She was born in 2001. There really wasn't any model for this that I know of.
Yeah. Well, one thing that she did say, as I recall, that's interesting, was she said, I saw you and Mommy were looking for a baby, so I came.
To you. Yes, that's how she put it. you and Mommy were looking for a, I saw you and Mommy. Her death seems to have been accidental. She went out for a walk. And then something happened. And then after it happened, she just continued walking. And so she said, I walked and 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 I walked. You know how children do, they just repeat things like that. And then I saw you and Mommy were looking for a baby, so I came to you.
That's pretty interesting. And I know that there were other things that were pretty startling that she said over the years, too. But at what point did these memories kind of fade from her awareness?
Right. And that's an important point. But at around age 12 with her, which is a little bit later than usual, many children who have these memories, and they'll start talking about them, some of them, as early as 18 months, 2 years, 3 years, which is when Christina started, is about the, you know, it's the most typical age. But they'll stop usually around age 8, often about the time they start to school. And the thinking then is that it's just with new experiences and things of going to school, they're just beginning to displace the old memories. And we assume that they're fading, when they stop talking about them, but that's not always the case, actually. There have been studies now where people have gone back and re-interviewed adults who as children had these memories and asked them whether they retained any. And it turns out up to a third do.
Yeah. You know what I think about a lot of, and I know from the research that there's a certain amount of time that usually elapses. Of course, that amount of time varies, the time between somebody's physical death and their reincarnation into a new body. But I often think, you know, we have these thousands and thousands of near-death experience reports, and, you know, we hear about the ones that very often they describe being told that it's not their time, and they return to their regular body after resuscitation. What about, I often wonder, those who go on to, you know, complete physical death and don't return, we think that's what happened, but maybe they went to a new body. You ever think about that? I mean, they go directly from one to another.
Right. In most of these cases, they wouldn't have gone to a new body immediately.
Right.
Now, there are some intermissions that are very, very short, you know, a day or so. And,
oh, really?
There are even cases, but they're just anecdotal. That is, they haven't been investigated. That make it seem as if it may be even, you know, briefer than that. But more typically, you know, there's some period of time. Now, it doesn't have to be longer than 9 months. It can be only a few months. So the reincarnation would have occurred during the period of gestation of the new body.
Okay, we're going to we're talking with Dr. James Matlock. The book, Signs of Reincarnation, Exploring Beliefs, Cases, and Theory. The website, jamesgmatlock.com. When we come back, I'd like to get into a little bit more about these, some of the typical types of behaviors that people report. So stay with us. We'll be back in a few minutes with Dr. Matlock.
The CAMLAC Center is putting birth and death back together again. Aimed at changing the way we look at death, the CAMLAC Center was founded in 2002 as a publishing company and teaching center. When we know that there is nothing but life, we realize that birth and death are events in time and space. Our grief can open us to other dimensions of reality and allow us to experience our loved ones who are no longer in the physical body. Our events and products are based on personal experiences of survival of consciousness after physical death and decades of research into how death has influenced the development of our consciousness. Visit www.camlac.com, that's K-A-M-L-A-K.com, for articles, videos, books, and more to help you cope with the loss of a loved one. Starseed Gems Studios in Cocoa, Florida fuses cremation ashes within art glass, making beautiful stones. The ashes are visible in the darkness and resemble a beautiful night sky. Starseed Gems, developed by the parents of a young man who passed away, are set in hand-sculpted silver and gold settings. Prices start at $150. Visit www.starseedgems.com or call 321-632-7770. That's www.starseedgems.com or 321-632-7770.
When grieving the loss of a loved one, sometimes a hug is just what you need. Hugs from Heaven are lightly weighted shoulder wraps that are made from the fabric of your loved one's clothing. Your clothing can also be made into memory pillows and sachets. Each Hugs from Heaven is handmade with loving care and is as unique as your loved one's spirit. Visit us at hugsfromheaven.com. That's hugs, spelled with a Z, from heaven.com. Who couldn't use a hug?
We all grieve in different ways, and let's face it, grief hurts. Losing a loved one is usually the hardest event we will ever face. We can throw our hands up and become hardened by our grief, or we can take positive steps to transform it. Love Knows No Death, a groundbreaking and powerful grief transformation method, can be what you've been looking for to provide some peace and understanding. It was created and written by medical doctor and professor Dr. Piero Calvi Perazzetti, and it's a combination of a self-help workbook and video course. The workbook has the power to lessen grief and foster significant healing, and has already helped countless people to not only lead productive lives, but to do so with the knowledge that they will indeed see their loved ones again. The workbook can be purchased for $19.95 on Amazon or on the foreverfamilyfoundation.org grief and loss page, where a digital version is also available for $9.95. Love knows no death. Truer words have never been spoken.
Welcome back to Signs of Life, brought to you by Forever Family Foundation.
If you are just tuning in, we have been talking to Dr. James G. Matlock. Our sponsor this evening is the CAMLAC Center, and they can be found on the web at CAMLAC.com. We want to remind our listeners to check the events page on our website, foreverfamilyfoundation.org, for all the latest events and happenings. And now to bring you up to date on what's coming up. Free this month of September coming up, we have on September 1st, the LaPorte, Texas Afterlife Discussion Group will meet from 1 to 3 p.m., on September 3rd, The Cold Spring Harbor, New York Afterlife Discussion Group will meet from 6:45 p.m. to 8:45 p.m. On September 14th, from 1 to 3 p.m., the Miami, Florida Afterlife Discussion Group will meet. And also on December 14th, from 2 to 3 p.m. Eastern, and that's 11 to noon Pacific and everything in between and on the sides, the Visionary Explorers Group meets online. And finally, on September 29th, our Brookline, Massachusetts Afterlife Discussion Group meets from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. The annual Winter Grief Retreat, Love Knows No Death, is up and on our website for the super early bird registration, which will end on September 30th. So get your registrations in before that. Mark your calendars for January 10th through 12th, 2020 in Fort Myers, Florida, and plan to be part of this transformational weekend in a warm and sunny climate during the winter months. Our next webinar is set for September 25th, 2019, 9 p.m. Eastern. Merchants of Light will be presented by Dr. Betty Kovac. In this enlightening webinar, she will discuss the return of shamanic, mystic, scientific consciousness and how it is changing our world at this much-needed time. Mark your calendar for Wednesday night, September 25th, from 9 to 10:30 p.m. Eastern Time to tune in via your device for this special presentation that will include Dr. Kovac fielding questions from our attendees. And for our listeners tonight, we have a limited number of free member-only seats using code COMLOCK2019 and half-price non-member seats with using the code Kovac 2019, and Kovac is spelled K-O-V-A-C-S. Our Holidays Pass raffle for 2019, where you can win up to 5 medium readings with Forever Family Foundation certified mediums Janet Nohavik, Joanne Gerber, Angelina Diana, Dustin Livers, and Bobby Allison is up and running on the website, so enter early and enter often. One chance is only $5, and surely you would love to help our work continue with a simple $5 raffle ticket and a chance to win. And please help us keep all of our programs going by visiting our website and clicking on the donation button. It's on every single page. Because of the work we do not receive the grants and funding that all other traditional not-for-profits enjoy. You can also help us pay our bills by participating in iGive.com, Amazon.com, Amazon Smile, and great nonprofits. And follow us on our YouTube channel for great stories and videos at youtube.com/afterlifeeducation. Back to you, Bob.
And we're back with Dr. James Matlock. The book is Signs of Reincarnation, Exploring Beliefs, Cases, and Theory. And Dr. Matlock's website, jamesgmatlock.com. So when we left off, I mentioned these behaviors that people report from their past lives. Some of them are pretty compelling. Sorts of goes against the argument that they're just extracting information. Can we talk a little bit? What are some of the typical behaviors that people will exhibit?
Well, you know, there are different kinds. The behaviors, you're right, are very important. I mean, it's not just the memories of events from before. It's how they behave. You know, and some of the behaviors are just typical behaviors of the previous person. I can use Ryland as an example there. One of the things that she did from very early on, before she was two, she would go into the bathroom and pull out the drawers in her house in Oklahoma and pull out the drawers of the bathroom vanity. It had three rows of drawers. First one was rather low to the floor, so even a young child would be able to. And so as soon as she was able to do it, she would go and she'd pull the drawers out, look at what was inside, wouldn't take anything out, close the drawers again. Well, it turned out when a few years later, when we figured out, you know, whose life she was remembering, that girl who had died at 11 had the habit of doing exactly the same thing. She would go into her neighbor's house in the bathroom. She would pull out the drawers of the bathroom vanity. She would look at what was inside, wouldn't take anything out, close them again. So that's an example of the sort of habitual behavior that can carry over.
I know that, anything's possible. I mean, people probably get misdiagnosed or misjudged based upon behaviors that have been passed on. I mean, even sexual proclivity. I mean, might someone remember being a different sex than the body that they're presently in, and therefore have some sort of conflict about who they really are?
Yes, is the short answer. The cross-sex behavior in these cases is quite frequent when there's a sex change. The young kids will often cross-dress. The boys will want to use lipstick. They will prefer play of the opposite sex. Boys will prefer girls' games, girls' boys' games, and so forth. They can be very striking when there's a change of sex. In most cases, in most cases, as the years go by, just as the conscious memories fade, the behaviors will fade too. But in a few cases, they are actually carried. That is, the cross-sex behaviors can be carried into adulthood.
Yeah, I could imagine also, you have a 5-year-old or a 6-year-old that starts talking to his teachers about smoking cigars and drinking whiskey. That could be a little unsettling and result in a trip to the principal's office, right?
Right, and there are cases of young children who have been found going into their parents' cupboards and sneaking alcoholic drinks and things like that.
Yeah, I mean, we... they're very evidential in the reincarnation world of the birthmark cases, and there's some sort of a mechanism that allows transference of these birthmarks that match very often match wounds of the previous person. You refer in the book to a reincarnating mind as a possible explanation of how physical traits can get transferred. So tell us a little bit about how that might work, a reincarnating mind.
Right. Remember what I said earlier, that I think of reincarnation as simply being the continuation of consciousness from one life, through the intermission period to the new life. So reincarnation is simply essentially a possession of the new body by the consciousness stream. And I think that probably what the habit... because. Really, what happens with birthmarks, and it's not only birthmarks, by the way, there can be a variety of different kinds of physical resemblances. Faces, facial resemblance has gotten a lot of press now, but also stature, so that, say, girls who remember lives of having been men or boys will be larger in stature than other girls, things like that. And it's a puzzlement, how can physical things get carried forward in reincarnation? Because the physical body has been left behind, right? I mean, reincarnation is not a physical thing. Well, I think that what is happening here is that the incoming mind, the reincarnating mind, is using its psychokinesis to impress the physical features on the new body. The same way that mind can be used to affect the body, in the placebo effect, or to heal our own bodies, or in psychic healing to heal another body. So the mind definitely has the ability to affect its body. And we see, we see the same thing in cases like stigmata, and things like that, where physical effects flow from the mind. The mind can affect the body physically. And so I'm just pushing that back, to the beginning of life and saying, well, maybe the easiest way to explain these the birthmarks and so forth is by the incoming mind is simply impressing the body with these things.
What about people that exhibit skills and abilities, from the previous, life. I mean, most people would think of skills and abilities as something learned or something genetic. What would be would the same principle be involved? I mean, would the reincarnating mind sort of carry an imprint or transfer that skill or ability to the new incarnating body?
Right. Well, skills are, of course, behaviors, right? But there are behaviors that have been practiced and learned, and. What gave me the hint here, the clue here, was OCD. Obsessive-compulsive disorder, where studies have found that when the behaviors are changed, away from the compulsive behaviors, the brain changes as well. That is, the neural pathways in the brain that have underlain the behaviors, because when the behaviors are practiced in order to be made perfect, right, it causes the brain to change, right? And
right.
So those are called neural pathways, and when those are ingrained, the behaviors can just become repetitive, and that's why they become compulsive like that. So, but when patients are taught new behaviors, it turns out their brains change too. And what that suggested to me is that behaviors, practiced behaviors, skills, have these neural pathways underlying them. And so all that would need to be involved in carrying the skills forward from one life to the next is impressing the new brain with these same neural pathways. So in the same sort of mechanism that I'm positing for birthmarks and other physical things would be involved here too in bringing forward the skills.
Yeah, it's an interesting theory. You also, mentioned that when people choose their new parents, as your daughter apparently did, there's an emotional component, and
yes.
that's the overriding mechanism that makes it happen, right?
Right. Yeah. There's some sort of emotional link. Now, a lot in the metaphysical community seem to think that we always choose our parents. Well, that doesn't seem to be the case when we look at the cases that have been studied, the solved cases, and we look at the intermission memories, that is, the memories of the period between lives. And as I said earlier, about 20% of children remember the intermission. So we have some fair amount of data here because we've got over 1,700 solved cases. So we've got we have a fairly sizable database.
Yeah.
Although it's still limited. When we look at those cases, there are children besides Christina who talk about choosing their parents. There are other children who say that they had help, they had assistance, there was another spirit. And when you mentioned earlier about NDEs, where NDEs are, the NDEer is often told, your time hasn't come, time to go back to your body. Well, in reincarnation experiences, sometimes you see the same sorts of figures, except instead of telling me to go back to the body, they say, come with me, and they take them on. And some of those figures will then lead them on to the next life, tell them where to be born.
All right, that makes sense. We have been talking with Dr. James Matlock. If you want to learn more about reincarnation, just about everything there is to know, basically, it's a very comprehensive book, Signs of Reincarnation, Exploring Beliefs, Cases, and Theory. The website, jamesgmatlock.com. There is an Amazon link on our website to purchase the book. Jim, thanks so much for being with us tonight. Look forward to talking with you again.
Well, thank you. I've enjoyed it. I'd be glad to Whenever appropriate, I'll be glad to talk with you again.
Thank you. Have a good evening.
We now ask our listeners to please join us in our global peace prayer. May the universe create a channel of healing energy from all participating listeners, sending that energy to those who are in need of recovery of the physical body, spirit, and mind. Let us as one consciousness give our energy of loving thought by praying like this. To love one another, to treat others as we would like to be treated, to forgive others and return love for hate, kindness for anger, to spread this feeling to everyone, to our fellow man, as well as the earth and its environment. And now it's time to say,
our loved ones are only a heartbeat away.
And science is going to prove it.
Good night, everyone.